The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Thank you, Doc. Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. That was Rita singing Sonny and Frank Sinatra saying, "Here's Johnny," the night he hosted The Tonight Show and had me on as a guest. This is John Barber live in Las Vegas for the last 2 weeks. It has been about 116 degrees. It's been like a ghost town with residents seeking refuge in Death Valley. I hope I don't sound too excited tonight, because when I do get excited, my voice gets rather high, and I sound a lot like Rod Stewart, who when he sings, sounds like Carol Channing. I am certainly not excited about Trump meeting Putin. I have as much interest in politics in America now as I have in politics in Tahiti. Mark Twain long ago said correctly, if voting made a difference, they wouldn't let us do it. Three things, though, that I didn't notice about Trump and Putin. Putin spoke better English. Putin had bigger hands and a sense of humor. Even Stevie Wonder can see that Donald Trump has neither wit or charm. And when he tries attacking someone with his half-wit, he sounds like a very mean Don Rickles. Putin humorously deflected Trump's feeble opening attempt to talk about Russian hacking. Putin deflected it as fake news, which was adorable. And speaking of fake news, our documentary, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, which catalogs with CIA documents the birth and purpose of fake news, which still misinforms us to this day, the fake news that helped destroy Jim Garrison's very winnable case against Clay Shaw as being part of the CIA operation that murdered John Kennedy. Our documentary last week was accepted by the Motion Picture Academy of America for Oscar consideration. Now, quite honestly, I don't think it stands a chance because it's a very, very tough film, but at least people in the Academy and Hollywood will know it's there. And Amazon today notified me that very shortly, and probably this week, they will be streaming it around the world for just $2 per stream, which makes it eminently affordable for anyone. And speaking of the Garrison tapes, I'm getting a lot of emails to this day, a lot of Facebook requests, asking where they can buy part one of the Garrison tapes. Folks, you do not have to buy part one of the Garrison tapes. If you go to, listen to this, if you go to YouTube/JohnBarbersWorld.com, you can see the entire documentary in all of its parts. It's broken down to different parts, 9 or 12 parts. You can see all of that for nothing. What does excite me, though, more than anything tonight, is my guest, who can be seen in part two of this documentary. As a semi-orphan kid in Toronto, I used to listen to two great Canadian storytellers on the radio, Gordon Sinclair and the most famous voice of all, known to everyone around the world, that of Lorne Greene, who went on to star as Ben Cartwright in Bonanza. Their stories were fiction, but better to listen to than my real pathetic little life. Today, decades and decades later, I listened to and watched another Canadian who is really a world citizen. His stories and reports are about real life and real events, because American media, as you know, has become fiction or propaganda for the perpetual war state. If there were an Ed Murrow Award for the best reporting on the internet, this man would be a leading contender. He has millions of listeners and viewers who find him so valuable they financially support him. His report about 911 is the most classic piece of journalism and commentary with over a million views that I have ever seen. He made the most brilliant observation about why there would not likely ever be justice or a proper investigation into 911 because America no longer had a DA around like Jim Garrison. As my mentor as a comic said, my mentor, Red Fox, said long ago, thank God and five other white men that we have people around like this man who is my guest tonight from the heralded Corbett Report, its creator and host, James Corbett. That, folks, is the interview that, the introduction that I wrote for James just a couple of minutes ago. I received an emergency email from him from Australia that he was stuck in traffic with his family and he would get to us very, very, very shortly. And I'll tell you something. I hate to see that he was stuck in traffic because he said he would, but I'm glad to hear that he was stuck in traffic with his family, because when I listened to one of his reports where he had a friend of his interview him about his background, he never got to the business of his family. So when he joins us, that is going to be the first thing we talk to him about. But we are lucky because aside from having James Corbett on, who has his brilliant video Corbett Report in this blog, we have my cohort, Joe Satilli, who, as you know, has the very best daily newsletter in America, and I'd be lost without him. I'd be misinformed and underinformed without him. And Joe is here to help us kill some time and to inform us all until James gets here. Joe, thanks very much. I really, really appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. Until the Beatles, here's Mario the Incredible Plate Spinner.
So that's funny, but I'll tell you what. Really, I was tickled I didn't see a whole lot about Trump and Putin in your news vandal. But I must tell you, I was tickled to death, even though a lot of people might not know it, how you referred to Donald Jr. as the Fredo.
That's not me. That's the Daily Beast. But actually, here's the interesting thing about that. That's the Daily Beast reporting on people inside the White House talking about Donald Jr.
Oh my God! Well, what makes him the Fredo? Now tell people who Fredo is.
Well, you know, Fredo. This is the Corleone boys, right? And
from the Godfather,
and Fredo is the oldest, and he's also the meekest and the most callow and the most self-serving of the three Corleone boys. And you know, he basically has to kowtow by sort of the middle to the end of the first Godfather movie to his brother Michael. And to be a Fredo is to really be kind of a smarmy butt kisser. and that's, you know, this is the interesting thing about the way this Donald Jr. story, when his meeting with this Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, over what was supposedly going to be about Russian adoptions. But no, actually, it did turn out in this like third iteration of the story. No, she had dirt on Hillary. And then we went there and it turned out she didn't have dirt on Hillary. And so he's in a lot of legal jeopardy. He's actually just hired a lawyer, which is very Fredo of him to do. But the story that is out right now is actually sourced from advisors to the White House. So these are people inside the White House sticking a knife in Fredo's back, which is another reason why he's so Fredo, because all of the rest of the people in the family just are willing to cut the guy loose because he's such a liability. So,
but now, does his father read that stuff? And what would his father think of that stuff? And what does his father think of Fredo?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think that the way I look at it, and this is just observational, I don't have any great insight other than anybody else, but I would assume that this would probably be your insight and probably the insight of just about everybody else who's observed this family in for any length of time. There really only is one child. It's Ivanka.
Yes, that's true.
And I would bet that by just because Jared Kushner is married to and actually sleeping with the one woman that Donald Trump probably wants to sleep with more than any other woman on the planet, that Kushner is probably above Eric and Don Jr. on the depth chart in terms of loyalty, personal loyalty. Because I could tell you, Kushner is a way bigger liability than just about anybody else in this White House right now, particularly with the story that was broken by The Intercept today, that he was seeking a $500 million loan from a Qatari billionaire bigwig, and this Qatari promised it to him and then pulled out because Kushner has a $1.2 billion interest-only mortgage payment due in February of 2019 on 666, it's true, 666 Fifth Avenue. And this 666 Fifth Avenue is this giant boondoggle that he invested in five or six years ago. And ever since then, he has been going underwater on this property, and he's been trying to get anybody around the world to come in and invest in it and try and save his cookies. He's trying to get Anbang, this Chinese investment group, to get in there. They kind of pulled out of it. His sister was over in China about 6 weeks ago and got in trouble because she was promising these things called the golden visas. If you invest.
Oh, yes, I saw that.
Right. So you invest this, hundreds of millions of dollars in America, you get this special visa to come. It's better than a green card golden visa. So she was like, hey, invest in us, and I know I can get you a golden visa. And that was a big problem because that's just trading favors. Now the question is, did the Qataris getting isolated by Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states in Egypt, was that punishment because this Qatari bigwig pulled out of his $500 million promise to Kushner to bail out his cookies on 666 Fifth Avenue? So there are all kinds of problems there.
Are Kushner and Don Fredo becoming obvious liabilities to Trump in much the way that maybe Donald Nixon was to Richard, or that Billy Carter was to Jimmy Carter?
Don Jr. can go start brewing Billy Beer tomorrow and nobody's going to care. Kushner set up his trip and all of the financial arrangements, the defense deals with Saudi Arabia. That's Kushner. The big Mar-a-Lago meeting with President Xi, that was at a time when Kushner was still trying to get Chinese money. He brought Xi in and served him the big, beautiful piece of chocolate cake. That was Kushner. Kushner is has gone to Israel to try and broker peace with the Palestinians, in spite of the fact that he and his family are funding illegal settlements in the West Bank. That's Kushner. Kushner is the guy who was involved in setting up the, along with Michael Flynn, the unique social media operation that was micro-targeting people on Facebook with messages, a lot of them so-called fake news messages, to drive people towards Donald Trump or away from Hillary Clinton, with a company called Cambridge Analytica. That's Kushner. Kushner has his hands in everything. Kushner is more in terms of what he does, not who he is as a person or his character. He is more Bobby Kennedy than he is Billy Carter.
Hang on just a second. I may or may not have gotten a note that James is available.
Great, and I look forward to listening to this conversation.
Doug, is James there?
I think I am.
Oh, James, my goodness gracious. How are you? What a delight.
I'm very good. Sorry to keep you waiting.
No, listen to me. I'll tell you something. First of all, you missed a fantastic introduction to yourself, okay? So when this show is over with, and I email it to you, be sure and listen to the introduction. But I mentioned Joe Satilli, who is my cohort, as you have a cohort in your show, has the most brilliant daily newsletter in America. It's called The News Vandal. And so to fill in, he was talking to me about Kushner and Don Jr., who's called Fredo in the White House. He's the Fredo of the first family. Anyway, I wanted to say that I was sorry to hear that you were in traffic, but I was glad to hear you were with family, and I'll tell you why. I listened twice to that wonderful episode that you had. I think it was episode number 162, where you had this Australian friend interview you about your early life and how you got to be where you are. It was adorable, except I missed a lot. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to fill in some of the stuff that's missed, beginning with the word family. You did not mention in that where you were born, what your parents were like, whether or not you had siblings, or where you went to school. Could you fill us in on that?
Yes, I could. Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Very loving. What was the third question? Oh, I suppose I could break it down for you. I was born in Calgary, Alberta, in Western Canada, to two English parents. My parents emigrated from England in the 1970s, but I was born in Canada and grew up there. Had a very loving, supportive family, two older brothers, so I was the youngest of the three, and just spent my childhood playing around in the rural areas of Alberta, Canada, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. But I think that was probably, it was a nice nice way to develop. It was always very close to the Rocky Mountains, which was...
When you were a youngster in Calgary, I was a youngster in Toronto, and my first dream, of course, was to be a hockey player. And
of course.
Miss Britton in the sixth grade at Adam Beck Public School said to me in front of the class that nobody ever makes a living playing hockey. The kids booed me, and so I never became a hockey player. What was it that you thought you wanted to do when you were a youngster?
Well, I vividly recall when I was 8 years old, I had it all worked out. I was, of course, going to be a hockey player in the winter. So I was going to be specifically a goaltender. I was always interested in being a goalie. But then in the summer, I was going to be a scientist, which kind of gives you a flavor of at least my wide range of interests.
What prompted that interest?
I was always interested in astronomy for some reason. I don't really know why, but I was always just drawn to that. So, I was always interested in and excelled in science generally. And so actually that persisted. And in junior high school, I remember getting a book, a kind of a hand-me-down from my brother that was like, it was a physics textbook of sorts by, I believe it was by Isaac Asimov. But it was a nonfiction. It was a text of sorts about physics, and that really captivated me and got my interest. And so I, from that point on, was planning to become a physicist. And in fact, even when I eventually went to the University of Calgary, I did start out my first semester intending to go into physics. And it was one semester later that I decided, you know, I needed to feed my creative side in some way. And so I became an English major. I did that old physics to English jump and never looked back.
In this wonderful episode that I listened to twice, as a matter of fact, you said you went on to English and you became a teacher, and then you went to Japan to teach. Okay, now, if somebody is a teacher and they're going to go to Japan like you, how do you know you're going to get a job? So tell me about how you decided to go to Japan and what it was like. Did you end up getting a teaching job? And what was that experience like?
Well, actually, the chronology on that is a little bit skewed because I didn't become a teacher and then go to Japan. I came to Japan and then became a teacher, in the sense that I wasn't really planning on being a teacher. I didn't get a teaching qualification of any sort. But as anyone who's, well, I don't know these days, but certainly on campus a decade plus ago, there were numerous signs all over the place for it. Go to Asia, teach English kind of thing. So one day I was on campus, actually in Dublin, Ireland, where I was studying at that time, Irish literature, and I met one of my cohorts, and I asked him what he was doing. He said he was looking for teaching opportunities in Asia, and I thought, hey, that sounds like a good way to kill a year and earn some money, see a bit of the world. Sounds like fun. So I decided to go and search it for myself. I typed it into a search engine, and I think it was the first or second result I clicked on was a large private teaching school in Japan called Nova Corporation. And basically, it's not exactly a collegiate school of higher learning or anything. It's something like a McDonald's type environment where they're cranking students in every 40 minutes for these classes. And the thing about it is you didn't need any teaching qualifications of any sort whatsoever. You just needed a university degree of some sort in order to get the visa to go to Japan. But you could do the interview in Canada and they'd sort it all out and give you your position and get your flight booked and everything. So it was all ready and all sorted out before I ever even stepped foot in Japan. So that was quite convenient. The original plan was really just to be here for 1 year, just to teach English for a year, earn some money, see a bit of Asia, and then come back home to Canada. But it didn't quite work out that way.
Are you calling from Japan or Australia right now?
I am in Japan.
Oh, okay. And you live in Japan?
I do indeed. 13 years
now. The next question, since you were stuck in traffic with your family, how long did you have that teaching job before you suddenly decided that you had something that you wanted to say? And one of the wonderful things to me about your story, James, is that I used to do a bit in my act about all the wonderful things in my life always happened by accident. And all the disasters were those things that were really well planned. And it seems that your magnificent Corbett report and the blog started almost on an impulse, almost by accident, as if you had to have something you had to get off of your chest that evidently was on a lot of people's minds, and of course it grew. So how long did you have this teaching job? What was it that compelled you to do the first thing that you did, and what was the first subject that you had to get off your mind?
Well, as the great bard John Lennon once said, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. And I think that's quite true in my case, because as I think you intimated there is no doubt that I had absolutely none of this planned out. There was it wasn't even an inkling in the back of my mind that I would ever even start a website, let alone do something like the Corbett Report. So it really did blindside me. I arrived in Japan in 2004 and was teaching here, teaching English for 3 years before I ever even had the thought that I would start a website. So it was the end of 2006, I started to become interested in all of this information that I was starting to learn online, because I had suddenly moved into a new apartment here in Japan that came with an internet connection. It was the first time I had an internet connection in my apartment for years. So I took full advantage of that and was basically just watching YouTube videos and at that time Google Video and things like this. But the amazing thing about it, the thing that was really compelling to me, was that all my life I had been watching programming on television, which is, you know, if you're at 8 p.m. on a Tuesday, you're going to watch this, or you have this channel, or you can watch this, or you can watch this, but these are your options. Well, suddenly I could watch pretty much anything I wanted. And I was interested in documentaries and history and science and things like that. So I was very happy to suddenly have all this information. But suddenly I started encountering all of these subjects that I had never heard anything like this before. What are you talking about? With regards to very contentious political subjects, talking about 9/11, talking about the monetary system, talking about these types of subjects that all my life I'd only ever heard denigrated as crazy conspiracy theory. Oh, why would you even think about these things? Suddenly I was not just finding documentaries and things online about this, but I was compelled to actually start researching the information for myself. And when I started doing that, I started to discover all of these documents and things online that you have direct access to in this era that in any previous era, I mean, maybe you could have found in the back of some dusty library, you know, somewhere if you'd really dug it out, but probably would never have seen in your life. Now we have instant access to all this information and direct access. And I just intuitively knew that something had fundamentally changed about the media paradigm that we're living in, about our access to information, about what all of this means. And so I started at that time to listen to a number of different podcasts. And although I had never thought about it, never even crossed my mind that I would do something like that, I suddenly felt compelled to start sharing some of this information that I was finding. And the ultimate outgrowth of that was the Corbett Report. It took about 6 months for me to basically get the website programmed. I got my friend here to basically throw a website together and get it all ready and get my ducks in a row. And then I just started putting out podcasts. And
what was your very first podcast about?
Episode number one was Investigate 9/11. As I say, 9/11 was an interesting subject that was one of the first ones that really caught my attention when I was going through this experience in 2006. So it was one of the first subjects that I wanted to specifically talk about on the podcast. So it was
I must tell you, James, that in the introduction to you, at the end of the introduction, I said that, that your piece on 9/11 was probably the most classic piece of journalism and commentary with over a million hits that I had ever seen. And one of the great observations you made that made me fall in love with you more was when you concluded that there would never be a really full investigation into this case, that we would never find justice because there was no longer a district attorney like Jim Garrison to bring charges. I mean, that staggered me that anybody could be that smart. And I became an instant applauder and fan of yours. So how did you come to the conclusion that you would include Jim Garrison in that brilliant, I mean, you didn't need to include Garrison because everything you said was just so right on. And as a sidebar to that, when 9/11 happened, the very next day, Hunter Thompson was on Australian radio, as you probably know. And he said, this is an inside job. You can Google it, Hunter Thompson, the day after 9/11. And I recall having been in television all of my life, having created that show, Real People, became known as the Godfather of Reality. When I saw a major event on the news, ABC, NBC, CBS, or CNN, whatever it was, we only had a few networks in those days, you would see four or five different shots. You could go to ABC and see one camera, NBC and see another camera. When this happened, it was all the same shot on all the same channels. And I kept wondering, why on earth were they doing that? And the only other person I ever heard speak out loud about that was Dr. Judy Wood when she wrote her book, Whatever Happened to the Towers. So anyway, I have a bunch of stuff about that And then, of course, I must focus on the business about Garrison, because obviously you knew something about Garrison that a lot of other people did not know. And so you included it in this commentary.
Well, I'm at a loss as to which commentary in particular you're referring to. It sounds like you're referring to 9/11 and conspiracy theory, my 5-minute video.
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah, okay, right. That's okay. Well, actually, I don't believe Garrison was included in that. There was the clip of Dan Rather on November 25th, 1963, after having seen the Zapruder film, in which he said that the president's head went violently forward, which of course is not exactly not what happened.
Right.
But I don't believe Garrison was specifically mentioned in that.
Well, which was the one that you mentioned, Jim Garrison, was at least 5 or 7 or 8 minutes long. I mean, it was totally, totally thorough. Some of it seemed tongue-in-cheek, which was wonderful because it made it really interesting and almost entertaining to listen to and to watch. But that was the one in which you included Garrison. Do you recall it?
I don't remember mentioning Garrison. Certainly, well, let's put it this way. I've done so much work on 9/11 over the years that now I get confused about my own work. But I have talked in, for example, last year, I did a series called 9/11 Suspects, where I did a bunch of different videos about some of the people that we should be investigating as potential subjects of 9/11. And I prefaced that podcast by talking about the idea that we have to prosecute 9/11 in the court of public opinion, as if we were prosecuting a case at trial. And the idea here is, if there was a DA, like a Garrison, but if there was a DA that could actually bring these types of charges and would actually subpoena people and put them, you know, under oath and actually commit a real trial, these are the people that we should be looking at. And it struck me it has been something that I've consciously thought about for quite a long time, that justice in the current state of the 9/11 of the U.S. justice system for something like 9/11 is extremely unlikely. And precisely because we do not have crusading district attorneys like Garrison, who would be able and willing to bring such charges to bear. And that's a sad indictment of the justice system generally. But if there is anything that I think we do have reason to be optimistic about, I'm not sure that's quite the right word, but something that is positive in this, it's that I think the court of public opinion has to a large extent already been won. There have been a number of polls that have come out in the past decade to show that there are a large number of American citizens who really do question about 9/11 and what really happened and do not believe the official story. And I think that is a step forward in the right direction. Obviously not towards the true justice of bringing the perpetrators to justice, but at the very least to making the likelihood of such an event to occur again that much less likely. Because
what you say, James, is so accurate. I mean, the numbers for people who doubt 9/11 are almost equal to the numbers of people who doubt the Warren Commission and Lee Harvey Oswald as the lone assassin. But my impression, my feeling of what I observe is not quite as optimistic as yours, even though I know the court of public opinion has been won, and largely because of the efforts of people like yourself, okay? But I observe that it seems to me that the American people have been turned into political zombies because, okay, put that on pause a second. I sent you a link to my part two of the Garrison tapes called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Did you get the link or did you see the film?
I have not. I don't remember receiving the link, and I don't believe I've seen the film.
Well, I will send you a private link to the film because you were also in it, because when I talk about the internet and the people that it's the birth of fake news. And that's the fake news started with Project Mockingbird, as you well know, that infiltrated all the media. Garrison says on camera that there were some in the media before Dallas that protected the killers, and that all in the media protected the killers, known killers, after the assassination. I hate to say it's just been accepted by the Motion Picture Academy for Oscar consideration, got just some fabulous reviews in America, and I sent it to you about 3 weeks ago just so that you could look at it. I will resend it to you. But
please do.
Here's the thing I feel discouraged about, being turned into political zombies. And I've told people, James, that a lot of people should not watch this film because as Jack Nicholson says in A Few Good Men, you can't handle the truth. Americans, if they are informed of the truth, as they are about 911 with your reports and about Jim Garrison with the Garrison tapes, they can do nothing about it. When everybody knew that weapons of mass destruction was fake, and millions demonstrated in this country, and nothing happened. And those war criminals, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice, are still walking around with million-dollar jobs. We all know the Gulf of Tonkin was fake. There was nothing that could be done about that. We all know that they accepted this fake NIST report, which is 911's version of the Warren Commission, so nothing could be done. So I don't think anything in America will improve in that respect, and I admire the fact that you think it will change. And then quickly, I need to ask you, you mentioned your family in the car. Tell me about your family now. Did you marry a Japanese girl?
I certainly did, yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. Do you have children?
We have two children, a boy and a girl.
And their names and ages?
They are 4 years old and just turned 1 year old, and I don't give their names out on air.
Okay, well, congratulations to you. Now, a quick rewind. What do your mother and father and your two brothers think of their young son who ended up going over to Japan and becoming this guru to the world?
Well, I don't know about guru to the world, but at any rate, they've always been loving and supportive. And unfortunately, my mother passed away 5 years ago, but my father is still there in Canada and obviously very happy that he has grandchildren now. And they've always supported me just in whatever way that I've gone. And I looking back now and being a father myself now, I realize just how incredibly wonderful it is that they always showed such faith in me to be able to do that. For example, when I remember it was during a weekend where they had gone, my mother and father had gone away for the weekend to Banff in the Rocky Mountains for just a weekend getaway. And it was that weekend that I decided, that's it. I can't do this physics anymore. My heart isn't in it. I want to switch into English. So I went and switched all my courses for the next semester into English related courses. And they came home and I said, hey guys, I guess what? I've switched. I'm now an English major. And, you know, my entire future, my entire life kind of switched on a dime. And they just said, well, if this is what you want to do, then you got to follow what you want to do. And they've always been supportive in that way. And they were supportive with the website. I know a lot of people, when they talk about these types of subjects, have problems, especially with family members and arguments and that sort of thing. I have not experienced that. I've been exceptionally blessed in that way. My parents were always quite receptive to this type of information anyway. So I don't know. I don't know how this has all worked out so well, but it did. And I'm quite in a way that puts me in a position that I know not a lot of people are in. And so I do try to make use of that to try to spread this information as far and wide as possible.
Well, it's proof of what Joseph Campbell said in The Power of Myth. If you follow your joy, doors open in the universe for you that you don't even know existed. Now, I don't know that I believe in that stuff, but I must tell you, with the making of the film that I just made, it is blessed. I mean, blessings came from all over the place when I started this film, and I think you will absolutely love the movie. Now that you're doing what it is that you're doing, what is it that gives you a sense of hope for the country that I'm speaking to you from? Because when I asked Mr. Garrison, because he was very, very conservative. He wasn't aligned politically with anybody. I was the only one he gave an interview to in 10 years, because 10 years earlier I tried to book him on my morning show when he wrote Heritage of Stone. And the day I booked him, I was fired and he was canceled. And I asked him, what made him think, because he believed the Warren Commission at first until he met Congressman Hale Boggs, and Hale Boggs was the only dissenting member of the Warren Commission. With his dissent never published, he disappeared in an airplane, as you know, over Alaska. And Mr. Garrison said to me, John, I guess as a kid I saw one too many Frank Capra movies, and I guess I'm under the impression that I'm living in the country that I was born in. Well, I became a citizen of this country in 1977 because as an orphan kid in Canada going to movies made in Hollywood, that's where I wanted to end up. And it is not the country that I became a citizen of. So what gives you this sense of hope that something might improve here? Do you think it will improve because of Trump? And on October 26th, it's in Trump's hands to release more documents from the CIA. Do you think that will happen?
I am not holding my breath for that eventuality. And in the event that some documents are released, my suspicious mind will always wonder what documents are not being released and how will we ever know whether or not they've really released all the documents that they said they were going to release. So I'm quite suspicious of that. And I certainly 100% do not put my faith in any political savior to be the answer to this mess. There's a lot of different ways of stating this, but I guess the simplest way is that we can't solve problems at the same level at which they are created. And I think the answer to the political mess is not going to come from political politics. I think my sense of optimism or positivity is not based on the criteria that we are handed as to what a victory is or what it looks like. Certainly, for example, when we were talking specifically about something like 9/11, again, I do not have any positivity or optimism whatsoever that there will be justice meted out through the justice system. I think we have to continue to strive for that, but I'm certainly not holding my breath and waiting for that to happen. However, as I was saying, I think the fact that so many people now do question the official 9/11 narrative is a type of victory, specifically because, as you say, it doesn't change anything in the sense that we can't. I mean, obviously, no one's going to jail over this, and no one's losing their jobs over this. But I think if we cast our minds back 15 years, 16 years ago, and think about the world as it was at that moment, and the world as it is at this moment, and think about how different it is right now, and whether an event like 9/11 could be pulled off in the same manner, I really do think the answer is no. I think, first of all, we have a public that is primed and ready and looking to scrutinize every single narrative that's coming out through the media. Whatever the media tells us about what people are thinking, I think it's quite obvious that very, very few people just willingly, blindly trust what they're seeing on TV, certainly not to the same extent that they were a couple of decades ago. And I think that is one of the victories of the alternative media, online media movement that's sprung up in the past decade and a half. And that is significant. It doesn't mean that anyone's being arrested or rounded up or that sort of thing, but it does mean that type of event is less likely to occur, or if it does occur, at any rate, much, much less likely that the public will be rounded up and pushed into the agenda that follows from that, the never-ending wars of aggression. And we've seen glimmers of that, certainly in the past few years, with the Hands Off Syria movement and others that have averted military action that was imminent. The bombs were being prepped and ready to fall, and it has been diverted. So there are victories like that. And I think it's important not to overstate that. Clearly, as you say, I think a lot of the same powers that shouldn't be are still in those positions of power. And we have to be aware of that and beware of that. But at the same time, there are signs of victory in that sense. Now, I think the ultimate victory in all of this is going to come when those powers that shouldn't be aren't in those positions of power. And that's obviously a much, much larger problem, and one that, I do not think the answer is going to come through politics. I think this has to be more about the reorganization of our society along the lines that are being suggested by the very type of communication that we are engaging in right now, that I think the decentralization that is an inherent property of the internet is truly the way forward for humanity. That we do not have to group ourselves into these gigantic ungovernable, really, communities of hundreds of millions of people that all have to bow down to the single source of authority, the president, who is some god emperor that can make things happen as people want you to believe, whether they're on the left and they believe, you know, it's Obama and Clinton and whoever is going to be the saviors, or it's people on the right who believe that a Bush or a Trump or whoever is going to be the savior. I think we are going through the birth pangs of something different right now, a decentralization that is possible and is coming into view with this technology. And that's where I think, in the long term, I am, if not optimistic, at least I think that's our only real hope. And it's an intergenerational project, to be sure, to deconstruct and dismantle this centuries of politics status quo that we've been living under. But I think it is happening.
Well, you mentioned the internet, and in the film, I refer to the internet, to me, as a box of Cracker Jack. It's full of nuts and corn, but if you're selective, you can find great prizes, and you were one of the great prizes that we point out. And as I listen to you, I think, my goodness, you're so lucky now because you've gotten to utilize your major in English and your skills as a teacher, because you're becoming literally an articulate and informed teacher to the world. But if the internet is the last form of democratic communication, it seems to me that that becomes a threat to the establishment, and some way or another, the establishment is going to figure out a way to dismantle the internet. Are you concerned about that?
Of course, that is absolutely. That has to be a large concern for anyone. And I think it's something that more and more people are aware of right now. Even just lowly YouTubers and bloggers and others are really starting to understand that there's a much larger narrative at play here. Of course, one aspect of that is this fake news meme that has been created in the past year or so, along with the attendant and corollary that everyone who is participating in this fake news, which is, of course, anything that's not officially approved by the establishment mouthpiece media, are Russian propagandists. So I have been put on fake news lists and been called a Russian propagandist. So I'm hitting both of those bells at the moment.
Well, the 9-1 piece you did where you name names is just wonderful. The fact that people name names is thrilling because, you know, it focuses more and more honesty and intention on it. And in my, God, I hate to keep referring to the documentary, but in 1980, Garrison gave me a list of people alive who should be questioned. And he's on camera saying that. Well, there are people alive today, including the Dan Rather that you mentioned. And what we did at the end of this film that I'm sure you will love, James, is we put together a 10 most wanted list of people alive today. This is an open case in the Justice Department. It's still a cold case, okay? We delivered this 10 most wanted list at the end of the film to the Justice Department. So I am so anxious for you to see this. And would you mind right now, my cohort on the show, Joe Satilli, writes this brilliant news vandal, and he filled in for you for the first few minutes. And I know you are his favorite person on the internet, and he's often sourced you. Would you mind if Joe asked you a question or two?
Oh, please go ahead.
Joe.
How are you doing, James?
I'm doing very well. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you, too. I actually have an affinity for Japan. My graduate degree was on the rise of fascism in Japan. I have a question that's actually a little bit off topic, but I have two Canadians here. I have two Canadians who know a lot about Americans. I have two Canadians that Americans have liked to listen to. And I have one burning question. Why is it that Americans find Canadians to be so funny? Why have there been so many successful Canadians as broadcasters, as comedians, as performers in America? Is it just proximity, or is there something inherent in the Canadian zeitgeist and the Canadians' position as an observer in Americans that makes them a valuable and trusted source of both comedy and insight?
Now you're getting into the politically contentious stuff, because, you know, My theory would go back to the fact that my parents were English, immigrated to Canada, and Canada is still technically part of the British Commonwealth, and under the British, you know, umbrella, there's still British influence, I would say, in Canada to various extent. I think that if there is a Canadian sense of humor, I think it is more alloyed to the British sense of humor. And for my mind, I don't want to paint in broad brushes, but I think American humor tends to be more on the slapstick and more broadside, whereas British humor tends to be more ironic and subtle and underplayed. So I think that there is, if there is any sort of national character to a sense of humor, I think the Canadian is more in line with the British, which to my sensibilities tends to be funnier. I'm more of a Monty Python kind of guy, or a British Office kind of guy than an American Office. But at any rate, that would be my guess. If there, you know, maybe there is something to the kind of colonial roots, I guess, if you want to say, of Canada, that has shaped the national sense of humor. But that's the only thing that I could possibly come up with. The other possibility is some sort of nepotism. As we all know, Saturday Night Live, for example, was created by Lorne Michaels, who is a Canadian, sure, and specifically sources a lot of Canadian comedians for that, which is obviously a springboard for a lot of careers. So there's something there.
Well, this is the age of nepotism. John, do you have any thoughts on that? Because it's actually a question for both of you.
Well, I'm inclined to be a lot like James in that respect. I'm much more cerebral. I would say that my very, very favorite humorist is Mark Twain. I don't think there is anybody in the world comparable to Mark Twain, except maybe Shakespeare once in a while in some of his plays. And I, as a former media critic for NBC, I attended, I mean, just hundreds and hundreds of plays and one-man shows. To me, Hal Holbrook's Mark Twain Tonight, I saw it three times, and I have seen only five solo performers out of the hundreds I've seen in my career to whom I gave a standing ovation. And Hal Holbrook's Mark Twain Tonight, as a matter of fact, the movie, my movie opens with one of the quotes from, two quotes from Mark Twain, but one of them is, if you don't read American newspapers, you're uninformed, and if you do, you're misinformed. Well, that's 100 years old. And when I was introducing James tonight at the top, I mean, when he wasn't here, he didn't hear it, I used a quote of Mark Twain's when I said, I have no more interest in American politics, as Mark Twain said decades ago, if voting made a difference, they wouldn't let us do it. That is unbelievably brilliant. And I'll tell you, since I've been immersed in the Garrison story for 47 years, the most single brilliant line I've ever heard about something related to this is Mark Twain asked the question, do you know what the difference is between a cat and a lie? A cat only has 9 lives. Now, he said that 100 years ago. How could anybody be that brilliant? And he's only talking about the Spanish-American War and how fake that was. He was the first anti-imperialist. And
Well, John, the other way to look at it is how is it that America has evolved so little?
Well, it has. It's like technology, for crying out loud. Look at what James points out. The technology that we have today, the communications that we have today, the contraptions that we've had today, everything mechanical and technological that we have today has grown leaps and bounds over the years. But wisdom hasn't grown an inch in 5,000 years.
Well, as a matter of fact, I had a story I put on the rundown today. It was something I saw over the weekend, and it's something I've been charting. Denver Post did an expose of people who are flat earthers, who believe that the earth is flat and that the thesis of a globe is a conspiracy theory that's being foisted upon mankind by NASA. And
how can that – listen, Joe, that was going around when I was at NBC back in the 70s. How on earth could that possibly resurface and get any kind of attention?
I have no idea, but I can tell you this. There are two major sports figures who have publicly advocated this. And it's sort of an oddity, right? It's this oddity in American in the American character that there is this great push for innovation and always a desire to retreat from innovation at the same time. It's the duality of what America is. It's actually kind of the root of America, right? The fundamental lies, all men are created equal, but we're going to build our nation on slavery. There are these fundamental lies that we tell ourselves that Americans have never really taken the time or had the will to square themselves again.
Okay, then I'll give you one more Mark Twain quote, and then I have to ask James a question. And this is another quote. It is easier to fool people than to convince them that they have been fooled.
Oh, well, yes, yeah.
And James has obviously experienced that with his reports. Now, James, in Japan, what is the Japanese public's feeling or the Japanese media's feeling about America today and the presidency of Donald Trump?
I suppose to summarize it in a word, confusion would probably be the best way. I don't think the Japanese are unique in that, unfortunately. I think everyone is a bit confused because, of course, if there's anything that we've learned over the last several months, it's that we don't really know if there is some sort of grand strategy to the things that are being said and propounded by the Trump administration. Who's in charge of this administration, really? If, you know, whether the Secretary of State really speaks to the foreign policy of the White House or whether that's a separate thing. I mean, it's just confusion. And so is the U.S. going to draw closer to China, or are they trying to push China away? How does Japan fit in with that? Do they want to disestablish the Japanese-U.S. military alliance, or do they want to make it stronger? I don't think anyone has any answers to this right now. So I think a lot of people are just very confused as to the direction that this presidency is heading.
Then the next question would be about, for me, about the Middle East. Why has the Middle East been a source of nothing but conflict since the creation of Israel? And not, maybe it's not because of the creation of the state of Israel. It would seem to me that for the horrors that Germany perpetrated on the Jews and others, the Jews should have been given half of Germany and not half of or all of Palestine. But why is it that the Middle East to this day always seems to be a powder keg?
The simple and short answer would be oil. But I think there is much more to it than that. And there's obviously there's so many geopolitical interests that align at that section of the globe that it makes it a very volatile region and has for obviously even before the creation of Israel, but since that time specifically.
Well, I must tell you, James, I am totally, totally and absolutely honored that you're here. And the last report that I saw of yours sort of startled me. Because I said to a number of people, I don't think that American television should allow any pharmaceuticals that advertise on television where if the commercial's a minute, it's 8 minutes, 8 seconds on the product and 52 seconds on the side effects, including suicide. I do not think any pharmaceutical should be advertised with those after effects. And I said to somebody, look at Bayer Aspirin. There are no after effects. And then I go and I see your report on Bayer. How did you uncover that?
Bayer has been in the news for quite a long time. This goes back to a story that was making the rounds, I think, 2007, maybe even earlier than that, Joe Scarborough was covering about Bayer shipping tainted Factor 8 for patients that they knew. They absolutely knew 100% was tainted with the AIDS virus, but they were shipping it out anyway. Bayer has been involved in some shady stuff over the years. And when you really go back all the way to IG Farben and the Third Reich origins of Bayer, that's when you start to discover the really uneasy stuff about eugenics and where the modern pharmaceutical industry really comes from and why it is so strangely laden with all of these side effects, quote unquote. There's even more coming out right now with new studies showing that chemotherapy can actually cause cancer and aggressively spread that cancer throughout the body, something that people have been talking about for a long time, but now studies coming out to verify that.
James, where can people go to listen to and your wonderful blog and to look at your stuff?
CorbettReport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. Thousands of hours of audio and video for free download. I hope people will use it as a resource to springboard into their own topics of interest and start going down the rabbit hole, as it were.
They will indeed, honest to goodness, and I will put it up on my site. Again, thank you so much for coming on my modest little enterprise here. When I get off, I will forward to you a private link to the film, which I think you will thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy. And if not, feel free to comment on it too. Again, thank you so much, and my very best to your very lovely family and your two children. Thank you again for being here.
Thank you for the kind words, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you, James. Joe, thank you. Where can they hear you next?
They can hear, just tune in 2 weeks. Everybody knows the drill. We're out of time, John. Good night and good luck, right?
Okay, thank you. As Admiral says, good night, good luck. Thanks to Michael Kim again for producing the show, and to Don and Doug Newsom for BBS Radio. Good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.